So with this session, I want to bring together what we've discussed about guiding change and facilitating growth. Because next session, as I mentioned, we'll begin to talk about niche applications. So life stories change in three ways. When existing solutions no longer work, when situations change, or if possibilities require new approaches. Sometimes you just come to the end of a story cycle and recognize you don't exactly have a new one waiting for you to step into. It's been said that the end of an era is when all its basic illusions have ended. So how do you make sense of new information that doesn't fit into an existing framework? Usually someone ignores it until they no longer can. As alchemists, we help people see possibility to engage in a transformative process. So there's some aspects that I want to highlight about this. One is to talk about three different kinds of empathy. We've talked about listening from an empathic perspective to resonate with the experience of the client, to understand their subjective reality, what they think, feel, how they put together things, in order to understand their system and their challenges and engage with them in that to proceed. So empathy is a listening perspective inside the experience of another. It's our ability to place one foot in the shoe of another to resonate with someone else's experience, including how they think, feel, construct meaning, how they communicate. To know, in other words, as much as possible, their subjective reality, and to not get lost there, to keep one foot in our shoe. As we talk about how we read and respond to others' experiences, let's consider three forms of empathy and some of the upside and downside of each. One is cognitive empathy, to know the perspective of another person, what that person might be thinking, how they think about things. This can be helpful in negotiation to find ways to motivate people and in mentor coaching. A study at the University of Birmingham found that managers who were good at taking another's perspective, cognitive empathy, were able to help workers achieve better results. The downside, only cognitive empathy can result in cold calculation, understanding another's point of view without taking emotions into account, a kind of informed detachment. Second, emotional empathy, when you can sense what other people experience as though their emotions were contagious, and we know that both emotion and states of mind are contagious, that there's a resonance of midbrain to midbrain, of one person to another. This emotional contagion occurs largely because of mirror neurons in the brain. It's a complex set of neural response patterns that fire when we sense another's emotional state. We sense the echo of another's experience in our own minds and bodies. This emotional empathy attunes us to another person's emotional world. Now, this can be immensely valuable in coaching. And it's important to remember that your particular processing of your intuition, your empathic resonance, will most likely be filtered through your system. If you're a visual person, you're more likely to get, say, an intuition as a picture that suddenly snaps into place. If you're more auditory as a processor, you may hear a phrase or words. If you're more kinesthetic, if you experience things in your body more, you'll get a feeling in your gut, or you'll feel it in your chest, or you'll sense it somehow physically. So it's important to remember how to read your experience, because each specific intuitive blink can be very useful to understand what someone is going through. So the downside is, with emotional empathy, the coach may have some difficulty managing his or her own emotions if they're powerful enough. So We have to protect ourselves from depletion, from psychological exhaustion, especially if you're a feeler. Now, I've done this, I know, with a couple of you, but here's something that I think might be helpful for you to do, perhaps as homework if you haven't done it before. Google intuitive empath, I-N-T-U-I-T-I-V-E, empath, E-M-P-A-T-H. Look at one of the first two or three articles that you see and read about yourself. We're all intuitive empaths, but especially what I'm focusing on here is to read about what you need to do to protect yourself from situations and people that may be toxic or that may be draining. Because of this capacity to be tuned into others, it also means you're more vulnerable to people depositing feelings or issues in you and then going about things their merry way, that you're can be a repository for the toxicity of others and find that depleting. So there's a way to take care of yourself, I think, that would be really important. And I think you'll see some aspects of this in the articles. Now, a personal example of this, in my own experience in Hurricane Katrina, we witnessed high-level leaders being curiously detached despite abundant evidence that they needed to take action. I saw on TV the suffering and misery that people in New Orleans experienced. My own response, since I did some of my medical training in New Orleans, and I go there and spend a month each year writing, was I know those people. I treated some of them. That guy wading through the water carrying his baby, I could have delivered him when he was born. So that's the downside, to get way over involved. Too little involvement, on the other hand, can be indifference. The balance, informed caring that doesn't get in the way of the client having all of his or her experiences and working on it. I think we saw a really beautiful example with how Amy handled her case study. She did it so that she could get through it, but it also allowed us to have our own feelings and our own resonance with it, rather than being distracted with her emotionality about it. There was just enough to know how much feeling there was, but it left all the feeling and all the experience for us to have, and it was just the right balance. So this is what we learned from the poets, to give it to the reader or listener to experience themselves, rather than expressing it yourself or telling someone how they should respond or how they should feel. So this is the art in crafting a story, a speech, to allow that emotional response to allow them to reside in the reader or listener. And third, compassionate empathy. The resonance with another, the experience and knowledge that we're all connected. So a judgment call in compassionate empathy is to recognize where you can and where you can't be effective in doing something or helping someone. This is more often the distinction that we make, to put our energy into what we can be effective in doing and let go of the beliefs or assumptions that we should be able to do something or someone should respond in this way, which can ensure frustration. A couple of caveats of empathy. When you move into abstraction, it becomes less real. There's a drop-off of empathy as we move further away from the real experience of people. For example, someone may feel more empathy for a puppy with a hurt paw than for a person without health insurance. The person without health insurance can appear as a statistic, an abstraction, one of 51 million others. So this is important in really knowing how we need to incorporate an empathic resonance in understanding our clients, and this is part of connecting with them to establish that common ground to then move ahead in strategic planning of what they do. And this is what we've talked about before. State comes first, then strategy, and then story. So let's look at mind maps, the brain story, and kind of revisit that at this point. The brain connections or mind maps influence the reality that we see. The mind map is the brain's story. A paradigm, which is roughly synonymous with a mind map, is a model. It's a theory or frame of reference that we create. It becomes part of our script. It's simply the way we see the world. What we perceive, understand, and interpret is our individual paradigm, our map. The paradigm now is the map that explains the territory. It's not the territory itself. So with the right map, planning, and strategy can make a huge difference. This is something we often, I believe, don't talk quite enough about in coaching. Each of us has a number of maps or paradigms in our head, our storylines. We're often unaware of having them, assuming that we see things the way they are. These paradigms, the way we see things, then determine how we structure meaning and how we think and behave. And we've touched on this before, and I want to reiterate it here. What we know now, very recently from neuroscience, is the brain works like a Google map. We see a situation, a stimulus, and it boots up a certain mind map or paradigm to deal with. It's sort of like booting up a Google map. We see a different one, it boots up a different mindset to deal with it. So this is where the challenge is in having a cohesive story and understanding to link all of these mindsets and paradigms that we have into a cohesive story and to be aware of their currency. In other words, not operating on software that was tailor-made for an earlier situation, but that this is the best and the most useful experience now and ways of seeing it. So we originally construct beliefs to make sense of our experiences in the world. The beliefs then confirm our models of the world. They become predictors. They become, without our even having to consciously decide, a way of being effective. And think about all the things that are on autopilot, that are the default modes of how we operate. We don't have to think through a new situation each time. We boot up a map. It reduces the size and complexity of a territory or a situation. So with this understanding, we can be very effective in taking action, very fluid, rather than, for example, each situation being overwhelming where we have to start over, and we simply shift to this frame of reference, this organizing, this mind map. Now, we help a client choose the most effective mind map. We relate it to something we know, which immediately suggests some action options. So the danger is to place the new into the container of the old, which could prevent new learning. Now, this is simply a way to say slightly differently that we listen for someone's story and we hear the patterns that get repeated, the beliefs, perhaps the blind spots. We're listening to the various behaviors and attachment patterns and emotions that result from their way of processing information. We infer the algorithms. We infer the components of story, but as we're listening, we're beginning to hear that so that we can highlight something with a client that doesn't work to explore that and consider an update or a revision or a new way of approaching it. So a mind map simply means we don't have to discover again each time what something means or its purpose and how to deal with it. So it's sort of like going the same route to work each day. You don't have to think about it. You can think about other things or listen to an audiobook. You don't have to relearn the route every time. So beliefs become effective ways to use our previous experiences as a map to navigate. And we simply listen with a client for what works. And a very simple way of thinking about it, if it works, it doesn't need fixing. And if it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. Now, in practical ways, it's more complex to bring all of that about, but that's a very simple principle. Now, UCLA research professor Marilyn Kurowski found that 97% of kindergartners think out of the box. Only 3% of people do by age 30. Now, kindergartners don't plan ways to think out of the box. They just haven't constructed a box yet. They haven't constructed belief systems and default modes as they do later, as they grow older. The box is a personal construction, a belief system that's actively created, consciously and unconsciously, to help us shape our perception and processing. So, at times, a way to think outside the box is simply to suspend judgment and approach something with a beginner's mind. It opens the door to possibilities. This is something we may do with a client to say, let's look at a different way to think about that. Or help me understand how you're thinking about it to come to that conclusion. One of our uniquely human qualities is self-awareness, the ability to reflect on how we think and what we do. By having this ability, we can learn from our own experiences and from the experiences of others. This is why we can create a new story. We are not our old story. We created our old story. We are not our habits or thoughts. We can think about these things, reflect on them, examine our paradigms to see if they serve us well. A dilemma means having two or more mental maps in conflict. So here's also where the work of coaching gets involved. At a macroscopic level, to select the mental map that's most productive for a given task, or to develop a meta map, a new map. For example, and as we've talked before, to correctly read the anxiety and uncertainty of change, of a new endeavor, as reframed, a validation of moving ahead beyond a comfort zone, rather than using an old model, an old paradigm of anxiety means a signpost to danger, better head for cover. Or at a microscopic level, awareness of the choices of this moment and picking the best one. And here's an example of that. If you label something wrong, you'll likely write the wrong story. You'll use the wrong map. For instance, if you feel bad saying no to someone who asks you to do something and you simply don't have the time, it's not a priority, but you feel bad saying no, and you label that as guilt. Now, that boots up a particular mindset, a particular paradigm. You're going to be using a different map than if you see no as setting an appropriate boundary. No simply means no. You're taking care of yourself. You have priorities. And this doesn't fit into that at this time. Two very different directions depending on the feeling you have and how you label it. So be sure you label something correctly. Here's an example of a conflicting mindset. A client of mine, an attorney, was asked by her dad, I'd like you to be the executor of my estate. And his daughter, my client, said, well, sure, Dad. First, I'll need to know some basic things about your property and wishes. And he said, well, that's none of your business. An immediate conflict. Remember that the map is not the territory. That is, beliefs are not reality, at least not consensual reality. Beliefs are only the negotiations we construct to deal with the subjective realities we each experience. So we need to recognize that we each create our own stories, to take ownership of the stories, to assess what needs to change, or be enhanced, or be ignored. And remember, as we've discussed before, any belief, like any fact that you have, is an anatomical reality in your brain. So you don't just introduce or have somebody else introduce a belief, even a better belief, and expect it's going to suddenly overwrite the one that's already there. Change can occur, but it's a process. So, first we identify the particular patterns that we use, the attachment patterns, the behavior and emotional patterns. Then we look at the specific ways that we maintain the beliefs or the stories that we write. So, just as you have to know the steps in order to dance, you have to know the beliefs that construct a story. Beliefs drive behavior. Behaviors determine the experience and result of what we do. People always make their beliefs come true. Remember the two anthropologists. If you believe no one will love you, you'll interpret behavior and perceive responses in that way, and even act so that you won't be lovable or will block intimacy. You act in a way to teach people how to respond to you. That comes from your belief system that will be lived out. It actualizes beliefs, validates your assumptions. And look at the blog that will be posted in the morning. The title is If Information Were Enough, but it's about the boomerang effect, that the smarter we are, the more we know, when change or a different way of looking at things is introduced, the more we double down and look at things that invalidate the different thing that's produced or introduced, and the more entrenched we are in our own beliefs. And it's called the boomerang effect, because if a new idea is presented, we get more entrenched in our own idea. So there's just a different way of looking at that you'll see in the blog. So one way to determine core beliefs is to assess the results you're getting in your life. This is the bottom line. The last sentence of the last professional book I did in 2012 about body self and psychological self, after all the theories and all the ideas and everything that I produced and looked at with you, there's one question that makes the most difference. Does it work? This is the question you have to ask. Outcome is not measured by intention. Intention doesn't matter. Results matter. Examine the results in these different domains, these different storylines of your life. Financial, career, relationship, personal, wellness. Does it work for each of them? Consider if someone's getting a better result, they have a different, better, or more empowering belief. With the same belief, you're going to continue to have the same results. If you change your belief, you can have different results. The most common source of resistance is to continue to hold an old belief and expect new results. So let's revisit now the concept of comfort zones. We've talked about that before. Comfort zone is a familiar pattern of behavior. It's a gradual response, but once established, resists change. So think of a comfort zone like a home thermostat. When the temperature increases or decreases even slightly, it signals an adjustment to return to the set point, the comfort zone. Our minds and brains both contribute to this internal process. We have a comfort zone with everything from our weight to what we order at a restaurant. We return to the familiar even if we don't like it or even when it's uncomfortable. A comfort zone, then, is kind of a misnomer. It's predictable and automatic. We know the outcome. A comfort zone can be a behavior pattern or a state of mind, like responding angrily to certain situation. It can be a repeated role you play in a relationship or procrastination of lifestyle changes you need to make. A comfort zone can manifest in certain patterns, storylines, recurring characters. An example, working under pressure, waiting until the last minute, creating a kind of flurry of activity, almost a crisis, can become a comfort zone. and someone can become habituated to the stimulation and the stimulating neurochemicals that occur at a time like that. Or someone can be an underdog and succeed against all odds. This can become a comfort zone, meaning a repeated default mode of behavior, which can be a repetition until someone recognizes and decides if they want to choose something different. Here's another example of a comfort zone in action. Most lottery winners manage to spend or give away their newfound winnings to return to their previous situation. In the United States, just over 80% of lottery winners over $3 million file bankruptcy within the first 5 years. Their money changed, but their mindsets didn't. Money moved them from their comfort zone, and they ended up returning to it. So, a habit is not a definition. It's simply a choice that gets repeated. And in the beginning, departure from a comfort zone is going to feel, by definition, uncomfortable. It's a rupture of continuity. A routine is broken. Sometimes letting go of a comfort zone occurs only when the pain is too great to remain in it. So the choices we make tend to be from our comfort zone. But a comfort zone can trade passion for predictability, creativity for continuity, and the new for the familiar. So, to break out of a comfort zone, your performance, even the money you make, operates in a similar way. As people get more successful, they feel vaguely uncomfortable, just sort of different, out of balance, because this is a new place, inside and outside. If the results go outside their self-image, it can cue an internal thermostat to return to the comfort zone. Here's an example that I heard Jack Canfield tell about his stepdad. Jack's stepdad, this was in the early 80s, so keep these figures in perspective, was a regional manager for NCR, National Cash Register. He noticed that each of his salespeople had a particular self-image of themselves as a salesperson. They were either $2,000 a month salesperson or a $3,000 a month salesperson. If a salesperson's self-image was that he earned $3,000 a month in commissions, when he got to that figure each month, he'd kind of slack off until next month. But if it were close to the end of the month and he'd only earned $1,500, he would work 16-hour days, weekends, and beat the bushes till he got to $3,000. A comfort zone is an unconscious thermostat until it becomes conscious. Then you can reprogram mind, brain, and behavior. So let's look at an extension of what we examine now in Master States of Mind about negative thought loops. A thought loop is mentally replaying the same thoughts and reviewing the same scenarios over and over. You can't find an exit. You can't logic or think your way out of something. A thought loop drains energy. Usually it's a negative thought loop. And leads to no new solution. It looks like focusing, but it's really obsessing. So think of a time when you got in a negative thought loop, an argument with a partner, a disappointing review, upsetting information about your child or yourself. Thought loops are being marooned in your left brain. And common precipitants include hurt or helplessness or disappointment. And a thought loop becomes a repetition then of the content in that altered state. Well, if I'd only done this, or this is what I should have said, or this always happens to me, or I don't think I have what it takes. Whatever that content is, look, think back about the neural conditioning chart. All of the content of an emotional state or an altered state with a thought loop focus is that second column. The first step is whatever the emotional trigger was to get someone in that altered state that you can feel stuck in, and to reiterate it, go over it. So here's where a combination of the neural conditioning chart to recognize the emotional trigger and what it prompts, the state change, that can immediately tell you, when you're attuned to that, that you have an altered state, and the remedy then is to get grounded and centered and move to an ideal state, an ideal focus. And when you do that and recognize how to regulate that state of mind, that result that manifests in a thought loop, then you can roadmap the negative thought loop. Recognize you're in a thought loop of worry. Observe the triggers that initiate that thought loop. Assess the best response, which you've done for column four. Determine the next best action to map the changes, to author new experiences, and then program new identity. Incorporate the desired changes into your evolving identity of your true self. So a couple of things I just want to mention before we close. One is about choice architecture. We've talked about this, but here's an example of choice architecture. And this is important in coaching, and I'll make the application because it may not be apparent up front. At a number of local car washes, the study was repeated over time. Each time a customer bought a car wash, they got a stamp on their card. When they filled the card with 8 stamps, they got a free wash. Okay, simple. Another set of customers got a loyalty card in which they needed to collect 10 stamps instead of 8 to get a free car wash. But for them, they were already given a head start. They had 2 stamps that were already activated. So both sets of people had 8 car washes to get a free car wash. Now the goal was the same, requiring the purchase of 8 car washes. But the psychology and the motivation was different. For those who had a head start with the 2 stamps, they framed it differently. They were 20% of the way toward the goal rather than starting at the beginning from scratch. Several months later, the results were in. 19% of the 8 stamp customers earned a free car wash. 34% of the Head Start group earned a free car wash. And this group earned their free car wash faster. They rotated through twice as fast, so they were ready to start over and spend more money sooner. So basically, there was a 4-fold difference of response just simply from the way it was framed. So this is what we want to be aware of in mentor coaching. How you frame something can change the meaning. People are more motivated when they get closer to the finish line. So this is something we want to emphasize and reflect with someone about the progress they're making, looking at where they are now from where they began and what's remaining to do. We can help them in this process take a few steps back and look at where they are in terms of where they've been and where they're going. This is a process they can internalize and use this in their own self-reflection. And this can foster a positive view and a positive affirmation of their own progress and process. So how you frame something can change the meaning can change your mind, and your mind can change your brain. So very often, meaning derives from the frame we place around an event or a situation. And the way you frame a question makes a difference. When companies automatically enroll their employees in a retirement savings plan, the employee has to opt out to not participate, to actually make a choice to say that I will not save for my future. When it's automatic, it's 100% in the beginning by definition, but then it levels out to between 86 to 94%. So at companies where it isn't automatic, someone has to choose to opt in, 20% participate, a 4-fold difference. Here's an original experiment done by Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky. He had subjects spin a wheel that would supposedly stop at random numbers between 1 and 100. They were asked, what percentage of African countries belong to the United Nations? For one group of subjects, the wheel was preset to stop on 10. For the second group, it stopped on 65. The first group guessed that 25% belonged to the United Nations. The second group guessed 45%. Now, the number on the wheel had no relation, but yet it was an anchor. The number the wheel stopped on had profound influence on responses. So even irrelevant information can influence judgments, which can then influence decisions. So these are all important things to remember. To discern meaning, you need a context to surround it. The frame can even determine your state of mind. We help clients reframe. Someone has a setback, a disappointment, or crisis. Rather than continuing to focus on the upsetting issue and negative energy, we reframe the situation by asking, what's the opportunity, after we resonate empathically with someone, if it's an upset, what's the opportunity here? We move from problem to possibility. Because we pay attention to whatever fits our story, the framework we use, part of our story is our self-image. If someone says something really nice about you and you don't believe it, it won't register, or you'll disavow it with an internal comment like, well, what are they trying to sell me? So how you reframe, how you reprogram your reticular activating system to determine what comes in as relevant. Natural filters include beliefs, self-image, and goals. So this determines how you proceed. Focus is where you have direct impact, what you can determine, where you can be effective. This focus and this framework is something we attend to as we help our clients in coaching. Because without even being consciously aware, we can focus on something we don't want to bring about. If a belief is that certain relationships can be painful and you have to watch out for certain people and avoid them, you focus on precisely that. People who can hurt you or dead-end relationships. This focus draws precisely about you what you don't want and attracts it to you. There's a white paper on my website under the article section about the neuroscience of The Secret. Probably most of you have seen The Secret. There is an important neuroscience principle there. I mentioned it before in case this is just a reminder. So these are simply ways to think about enhancing the story that we're helping and co-creating the client to work on. And these are things that I've just thought about and wanted to put together in advancing the plot.